You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm Caroline Hyde,
I'm Ed Ludlow, both of us in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology, and after days of venture capital dominating headlines, public market volatility hitting us smack in the face.
And not to mention the crypto world as well, yet more signs of concern there. We have got so much to digest. Coming up, Tesla shedding tens of billions of dollars in its market value after its investor day just fails to energize shareholders.
Then, why the Commerce Secretary told Bloomberg that US concerns over Chinese apps go well beyond TikTok.
And a live conversation with SEC Chair Gary Gensler about his concerns over artificial intelligence and crypto custody. This is crypto-friendly bank Silvergate continues to plunge after concerns about its viability. But first, Ed, let's get to another key publicly traded stock, Tesla, of course, which, look, didn't get much love from shareholders following yesterday's Investor Day event, which included another third master plan on this time, the transition to clean energy. Bloomberg's Sean O'Kane joins us now. And look, it really feels like we sold the news on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were expecting maybe more specifics on the product side. Musk himself had on the most recent earnings call called out that the next generation vehicle platform was going to be a big focus of it. And while we got some of the shape of what that might take and some of what's going into it, especially on the cost reduction side and the efficiency side, we didn't really get too much on the specifics. And, you know, we got sort of a tease from lead designer Franz von Holzhausen saying, you're going to have to wait for a later date to see anything more about it.
Sean, you and the team out in Austin, editors in New York, myself in San Francisco, 4 hours we followed along. Which headlines did we get? What did we learn actually from that presentation?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things for me, especially here in Texas, is that they finally confirmed that they broke ground on a lithium refinery down near Corpus Christi. This is something that we first reported back in September. Musk sort of confirmed on the Q3 call in October, but it's been pretty mum ever since. I've had local sources down there for the last couple of weeks telling me, hey, you know, we're in the local government. We haven't heard anything from Tesla, and it didn't really look like too much work was being done on the site. So they were actually a little bit maybe afraid that that wasn't going to happen, but this is their first big step into that sort of mine or that lithium supply chain that is maybe on the way to a potential mining acquisition. We've had some reports about some of that coming from Bloomberg and others, but this is really like a hands dirty sort of thing, and they're going to move really quickly because they want to have product coming out of that facility, refined lithium going to other factories by around the end of this coming year, early 2024.
Bloomberg, Sean O'Kane, terrific reporting in the last 24 hours. Thank you. I want to stick with this story and bring in Future Fund Managing Partner CEO Gary Black, who was at last night's Tesla event out in Austin. And Gary, the market selling the news. Are you as disappointed by what you heard as the market was?
I think there's a couple of things. One, it was going to go down anyway. As you know, going into today, Tesla was up 100% from its bottom. So, you know, there were traders and hedge funds playing the name because of this event, so it was going to go down regardless. But I do think that the Investor Day itself was, it was very aspirational, but it was really short on detail, and I think that's what you're seeing with today's move. And then, you know, I'd say the third thing that was a problem, there really was no product unveil, even though there was a lot of rumors and hype that there might be a product unveil, and there was no updated financial targets. So you put those three things together, and I think that's why the stock was off, you know, like 6% and an up 1% day.
Sorry, Cara, I was just going to jump in there because I noticed on your Twitter and other people's Twitter, you were hanging out with Ross Gerber while you were at the event. And as you know, Gary, he made an activist or a friendly activist bid, so to speak, for the board, which he dropped. His grievance was lack of succession planning, lack of other executives. Were you convinced by all of those 16 names that you heard from that there are others at that company leading the charge?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things that I think, you know, give Tesla some credit for what they accomplished. I think they made a convincing case. To your point, they have a pretty deep team. And, you know, in the Q&A, it was, I actually took a picture of this. There are 18 people all lined up in chairs in a row, Elon, of course, in the middle. And it did look like they had a pretty deep bench. So they get kudos for that. I think the second thing, they made a convincing case that they can actually drive costs down 50%. They didn't with this new, what they call Generation 3 platform. But they didn't give a time frame on that. It could be 2 years, it could be 10 years. And I think that's one of the, again, data points that would have been helpful to have. And then I think the third thing that, you know, was very helpful is they said Cybertruck is definitely coming this year. That's a big catalyst. There's a million, what they call pre-orders, $100 deposit. You know, that could add 50 cents to a dollar a share next year in earnings if they even got up to about 100,000 deliveries. So those three things I think were positive. But again, there really wasn't a lot of data to connect the dots, if you will. They made the case that their volumes will go from 1.8 million this year to 20 million by 2030. And that was a big, bold assertion, but there really wasn't a lot of demand elements, you know, by model or by segment to support that. And I think, you know, those are the things that as an institutional investor, we just didn't see a lot of.
Gary, what about supply side? What's interesting, they're showing a deep bench in terms of executives. They're showing a deep desire to have a lot more in-house technology, particularly on their chips. Actually, we saw a big move in some of their suppliers today. Do you like that sound?
I like that they're trying to do a lot of it internally because, you know, obviously they cut out the middleman. They're doing it themselves. We own Wolf, and Wolf, you know, because silicon carbide, they made the point that they're going to cut that by 75%. Look, Tesla makes a lot of claims, and, you know, one of the things that, I don't know who said it, but, you know, somebody said it last night, is you can't always take their claims literally because it takes them a long time. I mean, think about Cybertruck. They announced this back 2019, and here we are 2023, and it's not out. So it could or could not happen. So if I'm a supplier and, you know, some of the suppliers got hurt today, I wouldn't get too worked up about it because a lot of times these claims don't materialize with Tesla. So to me, like Wolf, we own it. You know, we think it's still a cheap stock and, you know, I think it's going to be fine over time.
Do you get ultimately then frustrated with master plans, with the fact that perhaps master plan 1.0, 2.0 aren't executed and we're already talking about 3.0?
Look, Elon is brilliant, and he's yet, you know, unpredictable. And as an investor, you don't like the unpredictability of it. And yeah, we get frustrated with it. When he bought Twitter, we were very frustrated by that because, you know, in my experience, it's hard to, you know, run two companies, and Elon runs three or four now. But Twitter is a whole different animal from SpaceX and Boring, which he built from scratch, right? So it's bad enough that he's got those two, but now he's got Twitter, which is a total rebuild. And so that's frustrating. It's, you know, it is frustrating that, you know, he often, you know, does a 180. I guess that's what makes him so skilled, and that's what makes him so successful, that, you know, one of the things people tell me about is when he realizes he's wrong, he will make an immediate turn and go in the right direction. And you've seen that over and over again with Tesla. An example is they took radar out of the FSD, and I guess he realized that, you know, high-def radar actually added value, so now they're putting the high-def radar back in. And I don't know if it frustrates me as best. You get used to him because he adds a lot of value, and he's brilliant, and he adds, you know, tremendous, you know, value from a you know, stock picking standpoint. But at times you got to be ready to you know, tilt when he tilts.
Investors left wanting more. The Future Fund Managing Partner Gary Black, really great to have some time with you. Thank you.
If what we're worried about is Chinese-backed companies being on, you know, tens of millions of American phones, including members of the military, and privacy concerns, data concerns, misinformation concerns, that doesn't just apply to TikTok.
That was U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo there talking about her concerns around TikTok and other Chinese social media apps that are said to be threatening national security. Now, former NSA hacker David Kennedy, who's now founded two cybersecurity companies, Trusted Sec and Binary Defense, is with us. And David, my question to you is, where is the vulnerability? Why is Gina Raimondo concerned not just about TikTok, but other Chinese apps as well?
We've seen for years that China has created one of the largest surveillance states, not only in its own people, but just globally, tracking U.S. personnel for espionage purposes, cyber warfare. They're one of our peer competitors on the cyberspace. They're the largest country for intellectual property theft, yielding trillions of dollars of intellectual property theft per year from China. And, you know, they don't play by any type of rules whatsoever. And the big issue that you run into, and I think what the big contrast is from, you know, social media companies here in the United States versus something like China, is that, you know, they control the content that is delivered to the endpoints or the phone or the device that is looking at TikTok, as well as the information that is collected that could then be used by the government itself. And that's, you know, government employees, locations, you know, information about, you know, specific individuals that they're trying to pull or pull any type of data or information on. They use this as another source of many other sources that they centrally use. And they're one of the best when it comes to large big data analytics and what they're dealing with, if, with tracking people all across the world. Right. It's a major problem and it's a major concern, especially from China.
David, you are a hacker, but the friendly kind of hacker, as I understand it. What I don't understand is this a sort of systems vulnerability, or is this an issue of who has access to data?
It's a combination of both, actually. So if you look at ByteDance, which is the subsidiary company that is out of Beijing specifically, they control the code that goes into the devices. Now, you know, Apple, for example, has a pretty stringent policy around, you know, inspecting source code and things like that. Google a little bit more on the open side. But the collection of the data aspect and where that data goes to is the most concerning part about it. Could they introduce code that, you know, could eavesdrop on U.S. citizens? Absolutely. But the main concern is the amount of information that they're pulling back, collecting, and then using that information to go against, you know, key personnel that they would look to target, or individuals or people that are of interest to the Chinese government, you know, scientists, medical research, DoD contractors that specifically focus on, you know, next generation research of weapon systems, missile defense systems, those types of things, as well as their ability to control content that goes to individuals. So obviously, you know, you hear the term misinformation quite a bit. But I think what's most important to understand is that, you know, they can start to home in and focus content on individuals and really change their perception of what's actually occurring in reality. And, you know, we live through our devices nowadays and, you know, live through TikTok, live through, you know, Facebook and Twitter and through various online news sources. So what is presented to us as content is typically our worldview on what's actually happening out there. So can you curb, you know, public opinion based on the content that's coming out of TikTok? And that's absolutely possible.
Gina Raimondo, of course, coming from the administration, there has been much talk of the administration doing something about TikTok, maybe WeChat, Alipay, some of the others as well, but dragging their heels. And so states have started to step in, or individual institutions, particularly in the, well, the education side of things. Is that the right way to deal with this?
You know, the outright of banning of TikTok is an interesting, and other Chinese-owned companies is an interesting dilemma. I think, you know, what just recently happened with banning it within government employees is a solid one. You know, we removed Huawei from being able to be purchased here in the United States, specifically on military bases and installation, can't have hardware in those facilities, which is a Chinese-based company. And there's been direct intelligence that have shown Huawei has, you know, worked on behalf of the Chinese government for intellectual property theft in other areas. You know, the interesting part is, you know, does the federal government play a role in what the U.S., you know, citizens can and can't, cannot do? And I think that's a pretty large discussion, heavy discussion to have. They've largely stayed away from that. And I think you're looking at states kind of looking at, well, personal information is really important. It's not just TikTok, for example. I mean, social security numbers, your personal data that's stored within corporations. You know, the EU does this very well with protecting personal information. So, yeah, I think states are looking at this and saying, well, can we look at this as a personal information issue, a privacy issue, and can we put controls in place that hold you know, that holds ByteDance specifically accountable for where that data is stored and how it's protected, not necessarily banning it. I think that's probably a better measured approach to say, you know, this data has to stay here.
Of course, the continued crackdown, U.S. still reviewing existing licenses from exporting to Huawei as well. We continue to keep our communications with that company open as well. David Kennedy, we want to thank you so much. Trusted SEC founder and indeed an ethical hacker. Meanwhile, we've talked about how the cybersecurity industry, perhaps some would say, is seeing high labor shortages right now in the face of all of that work to be done. But look, more broadly, it's an issue across the board in America, the labor side, that is. Here's what U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo also had to say earlier about some of the top concerns she hears from CEOs she's in touch with.
Workforce. It's unbelievable. Like workforce, workforce, workforce. We can't hire enough. We can't hire fast enough. We can't hire people with the skills that we need.
Look, so we went to you, our audience, didn't we, Ed? We actually asked them, look, does this apply to technology? Because I'm afraid the labor tightness she talks of, we meanwhile got all these layoffs.
To us, those are incongruous ideas. All we hear is layoffs, layoffs, layoffs. I do hear from tech executives there are specific roles they can't fill, like expertise. Mm. But pretty divisive subject in the tech sector as well.
57% say yes. Look, today's top concern is talent still in the tech sector even so.
We'll keep tracking that one. Now, coming up, Salesforce CEO Marc Benioff on the company's pivot away from M&A to profitization. The change in strategy seems to be paying off for investors. Take a look at that chart, Caroline. We'll bring you more of that next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
As we really focus on our performance, on our profitability, on the reprioritization back to being a core CRM company, it was really time to put the M&A committee on ice and just, you know, mitigate what we've been doing with M&A and just focus more on our core. And as part of the transformation that I've put into the company in the last 90 days.
Salesforce CEO Marc Benioff, following the company's reprioritization, it's back on profits. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior technology analyst, it's Anurag Rana. And look, as he reprioritizes to basically where the activist investors want him to, what should he be thinking of if it's not M&A?
No, I think the organic growth rate is very important for this company. I think that it's decelerating for a while. That needs to go up. But the big thing for us as well as has been that they spend way too much on sales and marketing. I think, I mean, we are not the only one that talked about it in the last few years. Everybody is looking at a company like this. Everybody knows Salesforce. It's been around for 24 years. Why is it it's spending 40% of its sales on sales and marketing compared to, let's say, Microsoft with 11%? I think that's where everybody got excited, and that's where you see now.
Yeah, but Anurag, you say everybody knows Salesforce. You've written on a research deck, this is the new Salesforce. What is so attractive about the new Salesforce?
Yeah, philosophically, every good company should take care of, you know, sales and marketing and profit in the same manner as they look at growth. From a Salesforce point of view, it was the only focus was growth for the past decade and plus, and free cash flow was not the biggest priority. And I think that's, you should have a balance of them. I'm not saying, you know, you need to be on one side or the other. The new Salesforce is going to be very, very profitable, I think, from the old point of view. The question is, can we see a decent amount of growth when the economy turns?
Hey, Anurag, is Mark Benioff still under pressure?
I know. I think he has, I would say, a couple of years without any problem now, because he's delivered in one go. I mean, can you imagine? His margin targets are well ahead of time. So I think he has enough time now. I don't think it's going to be an issue.
Bloomberg Intelligence senior tech analyst Anurag Rana, thank you very much.
The Security and Exchange Commission has been busy. It's looking into potential conflicts of interest with asset managers using artificial intelligence, specifically predictive data analytics. This, of course, as the SEC is also weighing some of the biggest changes to American equity market structure in nearly two decades. And, of course, it continues to crack down on the crypto industry more broadly following the fallout of FTX. Joining us to discuss from the BI Market Structure Conference, we're very pleased to welcome to the show SEC Chair Gary Gensler. Long day of Bloomberg Conversations for you, and we are pleased to have you live on this show. Chair Gensler, I'm just going to start with the day of news and start with Silvergate in particular. Its shares very much under duress at the moment because it couldn't hand in a 10K filing to you in time, noting that it was worried, of course, about, well, its ability to remain a going concern. Have you worried about the spillover effect here? Are you talking to colleagues over at the FDIC and some of the other institutions?
So let me step back, Caroline, from any one company, and for your viewers, we play a role in overseeing the markets, overseeing registrants, and of course we have a robust sort of cop on the beat, our enforcement and examination function. So I'm not going to comment on any one company or here. But in terms of the overall question about crypto tokens and the crypto markets, while they are give or take $1 trillion of worldwide market value, our overall capital markets here in the U.S. are well over $100 trillion. So that puts it in context of scale. But it is important that so much of this field, this crypto field, is highly speculative. It is not necessarily, and the investing public should understand this, it's not necessarily compliant currently with the appropriate laws of our nation to protect you, the investing public, to get full, fair, and truthful disclosures to understand what's happening at these platforms. So, that being the case, traditional finance, much of traditional finance being compliant, has some question and is adverse in dealing with what may well be, depending upon the company and so forth, dealing in highly speculative assets that are not necessarily compliant with their laws.
Yeah. Let's talk, therefore, more broadly about your focus and enforcement. I just want to bring what one particular builder in the ecosystem, the Ripple founder, had to say a little bit earlier, if you could just take a listen.
The SEC is kind of playing offense and attacking the whole industry. This is not a healthy way to regulate an industry. Your regulation through enforcement, as opposed to where we're seeing in other countries where they're doing the work, right? They're codifying, they're creating a framework that allows an industry to grow while protecting consumers. And I think that's really what the U.S. is lagging.
Now, Chair Gensler, I'm pretty sure you might say, well, look, a founder in that sort of business might be saying this, but what about some of these players? We've spoken to many who have perhaps been part of previous administrations who are now, you know, advisors to some of these companies and worried a little bit about the holistic nature of really trying to regulate and worried that it is more about enforcement rather than the rules of the road at the moment.
Caroline, there's nothing incompatible crypto and our securities laws. Our securities laws were brought about to protect the investing public against fraud and schemes and manipulation. And it was through this idea of full, fair, and truthful disclosure, registering with the SEC when you're raising money from the public and the public's anticipating a profit. It's pretty straightforward, actually common sense approach to helping the public in investing. So this broad field, we have one goal at the SEC is for them to come into compliance, whether it's the tokens, that's basically people raising money, yes, or offering these tokens. And it's also what I'll call the storefronts, but they can call themselves crypto exchanges or lending or staking as a service or other intermediaries to come into compliance and ensure that they don't mislead the public, but also that they don't commingle the funds, they don't take the public's funds and do things, yes, we just don't allow in our financial markets. We don't allow the New York Stock Exchange to also play with the customer's funds and make markets, run a hedge fund, run a dealer, be in the clearing business. We separate, yes, out those conflicts.
Mr. Gensler, thank you for your time. You've set out the goal there. And what I want to ask you about is the results of your actions. You have asked a number of names in the crypto industry to register their products with the SEC. Very few have, in particular, those that are most known to us, the bigger names in the industry. Why are they not acting on your requests?
Well, the law is the law, and they need to come in and properly follow the laws, and we will work with them to do that. But in the meantime, we will also look out for the investing public. And we've been very clear, for instance, about what's called crypto lending and what the requirements are there, about staking as a service. We've also been rather clear about custodying customer funds. And we will continue to do this. And of course, we would,
yes,
most suggest that they come into compliance.
Mr. Gensler, there are all types of subject matter crossing your desk at the moment. One of them is artificial intelligence. Caroline and I have been discussing all week what the finance industry is doing in often a not uniform way with regards to AI. What are your concerns about artificial intelligence, potentially conflicts of interest in the asset management industry, for example?
I think this is one of the most transformative technologies of our times. I was honored when I was at MIT to do research and teach both on AI and crypto. And I think this artificial intelligence, it's changing how we're going to drive, how radiology happens, and yes, how finance happens. Our particular focus is that robo-advising, and there's 51 million accounts in America that has separately managed accounts from investment advisors, brokerage applications, again, millions of Americans, that the applications are using artificial intelligence, predictive data analytics, where they may be putting their revenues, the platform's revenues, this is, ahead of their clients' interest, and how to deal with those conflicts where they're scooping up data on our lives, scooping up data from our, you know, potentially from how we drive our cars to our Fitbits to the programs we watch, and then marketing to us, differentially marketing to us, rather than thinking, putting us first, putting us, the clients first, which is, I think, really what finance is meant to be about.
finance is also, we hope, about transparency and about lifting all boats as well. And you at the moment are trying to transform regulation in many ways, trying to ensure that we have this overhaul of regulatory profiles so that transparency does come to bear within the equity markets more broadly as well, Chair Gensler. I'm interested in particular about some of the responses you're getting to that big proposal you put out in December, in particular the National Association of Security Professionals. They're representing women and minorities. As we enter, of course, the month of where we think about equality, in particular for women, we come out of that for people of colour for February. I'm wondering about some of the worries that they have about ability for minorities to participate in equity markets.
We put out four proposals in December addressing four different aspects or problems in the market, and it was really to make the markets work better for all Americans, working Americans of our great diverse nation, men and women alike, people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds. And it's really about them. Those are our clients, and that the markets actually, when they submit an order, give them and work towards best execution. And that we try to level this playing field, because so much of the market now, if you're a working family and you're just trying to invest in the market and you put an order in, it's going not to the lit, transparent market, but it's being routed off to wholesalers in what's called the dark market, and trying to level up that competition.
For now, the NASP, of course, have gone to you and hoping that that does ensure that we see continued inclusion. SEC Chair Gary Gensler, wonderful to have some time with you. Thank you very much indeed, Ed.
Yeah, just, you know, fascinating conversation. But I think, you know, Chair Gensler makes a clear point. He doesn't think that these nascent, more nascent industries are necessarily at odds with the laws of this nation.
Mm.
What we put to him was, well, why are many of these players not following them currently? And I'm not sure we got a full answer to that. We will try again at the next opportunity. Coming up, how the rise of generative AI is impacting every industry, and that includes gaming. More on that next with Sony AI's COO, Mika Sprenger. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
So, as we solve real-world AI, and I don't think there's anyone even close to Tesla on solving real-world AI.
That was Elon Musk there talking about AI during Tesla's Investor Day yesterday. Now,
Generative AI fever has taken the world by storm since ChatGPT showed just how far this technology has come and the possibilities it opens up to many industries. And that includes gaming, which, as you guys know, gaming. Sony actually just released its own Gran Turismo Sophie game, which now features an improved AI racing agent. Sony AI's Chief Operating Officer Mika Spranger joins us now, and I love the idea of that. I've been playing video games my whole life, where the bot that you're playing against is either incredibly hard or incredibly easy, depending on how good a gamer you are. But this seems to be an extension of that. Have I got that right, Mika?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is a racing agent that was trained to really be competitive with the best esports drivers in Gran Turismo, which is this extremely highly realistic racing game. And we did that last year, published on a cover of Nature. And this year, actually this month, we released it into the game in varying levels of difficulty. So if you're a beginner, if you're intermediate, or if you're an expert, you can drive against the agent, but we balance the performance of the car. So you do have a chance against the agent in beginner mode, but you can also race against it. 1v1, full head, you know, same cars against a fully blown superhuman racing agent that we released last year. And so we hope this really can inspire people to learn from the agent. And it's an important step for the game because, right, you know, if you are an expert in the game, it will take some time for you. And you need friends actually at the same level to compete against. And that's what the agent actually addresses.
Mika, a few weeks ago, we had Sonia Huang, who's a partner at VC firm Sequoia, on the show. And she has this thesis that by 2030, generative AI tools will be so good that they will be used to just dream up video games. And I wondered, what big picture work is Sony doing to that effect in the video game space?
So obviously, I mean, gaming has always been technology driven, right? And so we are looking at new technologies. Obviously, there's been a lot of buzz around ChatGPT, Midjourney, and these kinds of models. For us, it's really important that this technology is there for the creator. So we are interested in what this does to gaming creators, how it helps them create fulfill their creative visions. And so, you know, people are starting to take up the technology. I think there's a lot of things that still need to happen in the technology as well for this to be really useful for gaming. But we do see also, you know, people already starting using it, the artists are using it. And that's really important for us because for us, really, the creator, so we are a creator-centric company, is really about what the creators are doing with this technology.
Delve in there, Mika. What more needs to be done to the technology to make it really purposeful, really useful for Sony?
Yeah, so obviously what we see today is a lot around 2D image generation, but, you know, games are 3D. I mean, that's just a very big one. And obviously that's something that would need to be addressed for this to be really impactful on the gaming production pipeline. But again, you know, I think the technology develops extremely fast. GT Sophie was a Nature paper last year. It's in the game now. So, you know, the cycles from like high-level technology breakthroughs to actually bringing this to users or creators around the world is very, very fast. One thing I would say, though, is what is really important for us is really the ethical aspects of this, right? So we need to make sure also that this technology is developed in a responsible way. Yes. From the data that goes into it, it needs to be fair and transparent. You know, people have rights, creators have rights. These need to be respected. It's also important what happens on the output side. And so for us, actually, AI ethics is at the core. For Sony AI, we have this, we have a dedicated team looking at all the projects we're doing from an AI ethics perspective and really shaping how we develop the technology.
Do you need to be hand in hand with governments around this? We just had the SEC chair on talking about AI's use within finance, and he's wanting to perhaps see some rules of the road in place. Do you need governments to work alongside to build this ethical roadmap?
I think it's important for governments to play a role, but I think this is also beyond governments. From a Sony perspective, we have a responsibility for our creators. We have, you know, we work with them on a day-to-day basis. You know, in many ways, they're part of the company, actually. And for us, it's not just about government regulation. For us, it's really about making this technology for the creators so that they can unleash their creativity and their imagination. And so the human for us is really central. Right. And yeah, of course, governments, you know, play a role in this, but it's also companies that have to step up.
Hey, Mika, Caroline and I are having a lot of executives from the world of AI on at the moment, a lot of investors, a lot of academics. What we're struggling to understand is how can we know how competent Sony AI is at its craft? What makes you different? What makes you stand out from all those other AI players out there?
I would say two things. One is we have extremely high impact projects, and we aim also for, you know, technology contributions that really are recognized. For instance, the GT Sophie agent was featured on the cover of Nature, and that's really an important part of us to raise awareness about the technology, but also show that we are actually able to do that. The other thing is really, as part of Sony, as I mentioned, for us it's important that we focus on the people and how people use this technology going forward to fulfill their creative visions. And I think that kind of sets us apart, and our voice, I think, should be heard in this space.
Thank you for such a global conversation. Coming live for us from Tokyo, Mika Spranger, Sony AI COO. Really fascinating, the applications within gaming. Now, we just talked artificial intelligence. Let's talk, a little bit more, shall we? I chatted with the Macy's CEO, and he's indeed the chairman too, Jeff Gennett, earlier today, about how he sees AI impacting his own business. But first, we actually talked about the company's expanding digital footprint within the new Macy's marketplace, and actually it's to do with gaming. Take a listen.
So in the fourth quarter, we launched the Macy's Marketplace. We did this in September. We've added 20 new categories and 500 new brands as a result of Marketplace. And that gives customers a lot more choices. Example, so during the fourth quarter, two of the hottest categories for us in Marketplace that we really didn't have in our owned inventory from before was video games and electronics. Those are where customers, they trust Macy's as a brand. And so they're ready to transact with us if we have the right content for them. So much of our business starts on digital or is transacted on digital. So to have Marketplace that a customer, they don't know whether or not it's Marketplace or Vendor Direct or owned inventory. They just know that when they come to Macy's, they can get a broad range of categories at great values. So that's what we're so encouraged by. So what you heard us talk about today was we're going to be adding 2,000 new brands in 23 on the Macy's side, and we're going to be adding a Bloomingdale's marketplace in the back half of 23. So it just gives us a lot of flexibility because we're a trusted brand. We're a department store that has many categories and about to have a lot more as a result of Marketplace.
And you really understood that omni-channel balance. I'm going to ask you there for maybe a bit of a curveball, but maybe one that's being asked a lot more of you. AI, artificial intelligence, it seems to be something that some of your competitors are talking up, at least. Is it something that you embrace with Macy's?
So I'll put that in the camp of kind of data and analytics, AI. Absolutely. So when you look at the technology that we have and that we've invested in, and when you look at the science that we have that we're putting against the art of the business, it's the combination of that that makes a great retailer. So art and science is so important. Where are the trends going? You can't always see that in an algorithm, but boy, you can look at all the signals. You can aggregate them for in real time and what's going on in the balance of the industry. Where customers are, where they are on Instagram and how they're responding to new trends. And how do you express that in each of your individual brands? What we see is that our customers at Bloomingdale's, they're upfront with trends. And when they move off of a trend, you can see where that might cool based on trend curves on the Macy's side. So we're using all of the data that we have. We've built up our data analytics capability. We built a center of excellence over the past couple of years. That's paying dividends. When you look at dynamic pricing, to be able to scrape the entire internet on where the prices are on commodities, and now in real time you can make adjustments online and in some respects in store. So we were clearly using, where science is taking us to better respond to this customer who's got so many choices, and they're looking for the best combination of product, value, and experience. And we have a huge opportunity to get that right. And to do that in real time is an important component of who's going to win in retail.
It's been going viral. Elon Musk, while heading climate-friendly companies, made a ton of trips on his private jet, some even as short as 13 minutes. Bloomberg Businessweek spent weeks navigating Musk's 2022 travels. In total, he took more than 170 flights. 170, amounting to a dozen trips around the Earth, Caroline. December was his busiest travel month, not surprised, notching 55,000 miles. Look at how he ranks against the pantheon of tech greats in his global travel.
But what's also amazing is the short distances at times he's doing. At one point, he went, from the SpaceX headquarters...
Hawthorne.
...to 6 miles to the LAX.
Before he went to Fraser.
That's it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. We're about to have a very big goodbye to someone special here. I'll be tweeting about it. Amazing week so far.
Jose Valenzuela, we love you.
This is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.